This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, I'm Eli Sussman, and welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. Today on the show, I'm joined by Lauren and Peter Lemos, co-owners of Wax Paper Company, the neighborhood sandwich shop that has garnered much acclaim since opening. The sandwiches at Wax Paper are named after the stars of National Public Radio. So when you go in, you'll see people feasting on an Ira Glass, or maybe eating an overstuffed Garth Trinidad, a sandwich consisting of roasted turkey, cabbage citrus serrano chili slaw, pickled carrots, miso and sesame oil, cilantro, furikake, and sliced almonds on focaccia that Time Out recently named the number one best sandwich in the world. Lauren and Peter met at Umami Katessen, an offshoot of the popular Umami Burger concept, and also worked together at Eleni Oyster Bar, where they both continued to hone their skills and zero in on their dream of opening their own place. With over 30 years of hospitality experience between them, they decided it was time to launch their own concept. So built on a shoestring budget with a shoebox-like square footage, Wax Paper opened with a very small, very tight menu in 2015. Now with two locations of Wax Paper, a growing team, and a new restaurant concept called Lingua Franca on the way, Lauren and Peter sat down to share their story of opening their small restaurant and truly figuring it all out along the way. If you're an industry veteran looking to start your own thing, this episode is totally for you. Get ready for a wonderful, wide-ranging, and expansive conversation that could have gone on even longer if we all didn't have to get back to work at our restaurants. In this extra-large episode of The Line, we cover build-outs, dealing with banks, cooking with constraints, how to build a better business for the long term, and of course, we talk about navigating a restaurant during COVID. Now, on to the episode.
You two are partners in business, partners in life. What is it like to do that, to basically 24/7 be together? And how do you, if you do, how do you separate out time that is not Wax Paper from when you're at the actual businesses?
It's hard. It's really hard. I think what helps our relationship and partnership is that we met working in a restaurant. We both have worked in restaurants for a really long time, and we're different people. We're polar opposites, really, but it works. And so I think, you know, carving out the time, the quality time, is not always realistic, as you know. Also, we love what we do. So sometimes we come home and we just get these ideas and just we're talking about work and we're like, okay with it, you know? I think where something we talked about a lot where it becomes difficult is when you do the same thing and you go through the same day, you don't have someone to come home to and sort of vent about your day because you both already went through it. So in essence, you'd just be dredging up like the same stuff you already went through, you know? And so that can feel isolating sometimes, I think, and maybe even cause sort of like, I don't know, maybe we just come home and we don't talk, right? And we're just like, we have nothing to say because we just went through the same day. So we've really tried to stay conscious of that and just try to, you know, one of the things that's helped is Peter's sort of taken over, overseeing one of the stores and me the other. And so we kind of have different days now. We have different things to talk about. But yeah, it's tough. As far as working together, though, like I know it sounds cheesy, but I mean, we work incredibly well together. We rarely disagree on issues. It's usually like he takes one road and I take another and we're like, cool, you know? And then occasionally, you know, when it comes down to something that we feel really passionate about, then we're like, no, like, I really don't think, but speaking honestly, like, I really just defer to Peter because most of his ideas have really, all of his ideas have really panned out. I know we'll get more into it, but I think just being small, really, really showed how beneficial that was during the pandemic. So long answer to a,
no, that's great. before we even actually like move on to the talking about the specific businesses, I want to actually continue talking about you two and just how it was kind of the idea was born. So you say that you're polar opposites, but you both worked a lot in hospitality beforehand. So which came first, the idea for the business or the relationship? Were you already together and then thought, you know what, we should join forces and leave our jobs and start a business together? Or were you at the same restaurant and the idea started percolating? Like, which came first and then how was it born?
Yeah, I think, well, the relationship definitely came first. That was like, there was an attraction and, you know, a relationship was formed working in a restaurant. I was working in the kitchen. Lauren was working in the front. And, you know, we met and fell in love and we got married. I think a lot of it is like timing, right? It's like timing in life. You know, we met each other at a particular point in our lives where I think we were both ready to, you know, maybe take a leap or stop, you know, or, you know, try to really create something for ourselves. You know, we were married and opened the business within the first year of marriage. So we were, you know, the relationship was first. And I think, you know, professionally for me, I was at a point in my life where I was, you know, like seeing other people around me, you know, open their own businesses and be, you know, be sort of in charge of their life in a way that I didn't really feel like I was, but I felt like, you know, now or never. I don't know. I get really philosophical. I really enjoy the big questions in life. You know, it was sort of like, why not us? You know, if it's not us, you know, it's going to be somebody else. You know, Lauren's extremely creative and, you know, is an amazing, person and extremely hospitable and nice and charming. And, you know, with just the balance of that with my sort of intellectual food creativity, I thought could be really special. And, you know, I was working at a place that I was like, you know what? I think it's time to try to do something. And Lauren was on board. I think we just sort of, you know, we both had a, you know, I was kind of surprised. I think I brought it up and I was kind of surprised. Lauren was like, yeah, let's do it. And I was like, okay, let's do it. And you know, talk about a huge leap. It was just like, you know, being creative with food or, you know, being a great server is one thing, but then like opening a business and like we were, you know, this is sort of, I think, you know, people were doing pop-ups, but we always wanted to have a business, a brick and mortar, a place you can come and a place that's sort of invested in the community every single day. It becomes sort of like its own thing. It's not sort of like a traveling, you know, it's one thing. And that was always our desire, I think, to sort of, you know, create this concept and this restaurant in a space.
I remember like being at my apartment and we were sitting at the table and I had, I think, 7 tax forms that year, like 7 W-2s, because I was working at a bakery and a restaurant and I was working for a catering company and I was doing voiceover stuff. And it was like, oh my God, like I was working at the Ace Hotel. It was like, I literally had 7 different jobs. And so I said to Peter, I was like, you know, at any given time, I said to Peter, I'm like, dude, just leave your job. I got the hustle. I want to do this. We planned to move in together. It wasn't like a convenience. It was sort of time for us and our relationship to move in together. And I remember like the idea was really born because Peter said like, you know, I just really want to do a sandwich shop because I'd make family meal. I'd make sandwiches. I want to make a place where industry people want to come after their shift and get something elevated, you know, but not pretentious. but like more than, you know, more than just two pieces of bread, and which we love too. We do love just like two pieces of white bread and meat. Like that's, there's no, you know, no moving away from that. But yeah, I think it was just like kind of a perfect timing.
Yeah, that was really like the impetus was like a place for restaurant people to come on their day off that was a little more creative than fast food, but not like you're going to a restaurant. Because when you're like working in a restaurant, you know, you don't want to go. It's fine every now and then to go and out and have like a great meal. But like, I think like for me personally, and for Lauren, like on our days off, we wanted something delicious. And we wanted something that was wouldn't necessarily break the bank, something that was a little less formal than like, you know, sitting in a fine dining restaurant. And, you know, I think like if we with our restaurant background, we really felt like if we make something cool that was like other restaurant people would get it. And if other restaurant people would understand it, then that was sort of like that was like the first goal. That was the goal of like other restaurant people could get it. Then we knew like, cool, we knew we're onto something.
Yeah, I totally hear that point exactly, because it's so amazing that you say that. It's actually exactly how Samisa came to be. And we really wanted to do, you know, chicken over rice. And when you strip something down to its, you know, bare bones, okay, you're doing sandwiches, but you're doing them in a very thoughtful way. And we'll talk about how you come up with them and ingredients, but you know, it's cool that you had in mind, you thought, who could our consumer be? Well, someone who truly really cares about food, which is people that work in restaurants. And you saw an opening in the marketplace, which was, well, this is what I want to eat every day. I know that other people are going to want to eat this every day. That seems like a business, and so going from idea, which is you're making family meal, and everyone says, "Wow, these are really good sandwiches," and then you say, "Let's put pen to paper and let's start building this out as a concept." What were the steps that you took to actually start that business? So, like from my perspective, you know, I had run a restaurant for someone else, but you don't get down into the nitty gritty of, there's a lot of stuff that you can kick to a GM or an owner. You know, you're like, oh, I don't know what I do in that situation, because I just call the owner and I say, hey, this is broken, or someone came in and complained, or hey, we need a new piece of equipment. So like, even though you both had a combined 30 years of experience, I'm wondering what were like the really concrete steps that you took besides, you know, maybe making a business plan. Like, how did you get ready to open up your business? What did you do? People listening are going to want to know, like, how did you go from the napkin to the two locations?
Yeah.
Oh, there's so much to cover.
Yeah. I mean, how long is this episode? We could go. I think the most important thing for us was like, we really were honest with ourselves and we really said, is this a good idea? Like, honestly, objectively, like, will this work? Do we believe in ourselves enough? Like, you have to, if you're going to establish a business like that, you really have to believe in yourself and you have to be honest with yourself. Like, yes, this is a good idea, or actually, no, this needs a little bit more tweaking.
You hear people say like, I saw it through, and you kind of hear that and you're like, okay, whatever, you know, like you saw the vision, like what else, you know? I swear to God, we saw it. We were like, okay, like we're going to have a record player in there and we're going to have like a picture that I took in high school at a Locust show. And it's going to be like not crafted to look like punk rock. It's going to be punk rock because that's what we were for so long. And like, we're going to do us, and we're going to take everything that we love and don't love about this industry, and we're going to hold on to it, or we're going to throw it out the window. You know, like, we worked jobs where we couldn't even get direct deposit for our paychecks. So like, go in on your day off and pick up your paycheck, which, by the way, you are supposed to be paid for, just calling that out, but never was paid for that. Never. But you know, like direct deposit, like, come on. Okay. So we were literally like, we're going to have direct deposit. Oh my God. You know, like it was like this big idea. Or, you know what? Like I had to wear a tie in catering so much and I love ties, but like, it wasn't me, you know? And I was like, I just never felt like myself, never felt like I could be myself, like tending bars. I always felt like I was just stiff. No uniforms, like no, you know, tasteful t-shirts, but like no uniforms. So we're going to get rid of that. So we just kind of took each little detail and planned it out and saw it through, like saw a vision through. And then the other element of that, you know, what sounds to be like, wow, they planned so much, is we had no idea what we were doing. We were completely green, worked in restaurants, never owned a restaurant. To be honest, my highest level of restaurant service was a supervisor. And I never cared to like climb the ladder. I loved serving tables. I loved tending bar. Being a supervisor was cool. But I was just like, all right, you know, how do I own a restaurant? Do I need to take a course? Do I need to? But it was already there. The way that you, and you know, working in restaurants, the way that you become a restaurant owner is to work in restaurants. And you know, Suzanne Barr talked about it in one of your episodes, which was such an inspiring, amazing episode, and what an inspiring person she is. And but she said, you know, our partners, they had no experience. They were real estate brokers. We see this all the time. Like people are just like, you know what? I'm gonna open a restaurant. I'm bored with my day job. I've never worked in one. So it wasn't. Sorry, bitter party of one, but it wasn't that. We knew what we were doing, but yet we also were so green and literally like, how do we permit this place? Do we sign a lease? Do we, you know, we didn't know what options were. We literally did not know what a restaurant expediter was. I'm not even kidding you. Probably couldn't have afforded one if we did. We had no business partners. This was us. We were throwing our pennies in the pot and we were doing this. We had no idea. We'd never heard of a restaurant expediter.
Didn't even know you had to submit plans to the health department.
We literally went to the county. We went to the county in the city 4 times a week. Us. We showed up and like took a number and sat there and like people like treated us like shit. And like we permitted the entire restaurant ourselves. Like it was ridiculous. So I think, you know, I kind of got off the rails, but to answer your question, we started bit by bit. And the most important thing I think is what is free? And I say that, like, what is monetarily free? Okay, Instagram is free. Social media is free. You know, word of mouth is free. Posters, not totally free. You got to pay some money to print them. But like, okay, what now? Let's start. Now we're starting to spend some money. So what's like the most inexpensive thing? Okay, we'll get an LLC. We'll go to Dear Robert Shapiro's LegalZoom and get an LLC and do it. So we got an LLC. We're like, okay, we're a business now. Now we got to get a seller's permit. So we just kind of did it piece by piece, which was,
I love that,
incredibly excruciating.
After a notice from the city, we're like, oh, we need a seller's permit. Okay. Yeah. How do we do that? Yeah. Like figuring out stuff like, oh, we haven't paid our annual LLC tax. Oh, I didn't realize we had to do that. Okay, let's go pay that. So like just learning and like believing, never doubting, like just this is what we're going to do and it's going to happen.
Seeing
like whatever gets in our way, we're going to figure it out and we're going to make it happen.
There's a certain kind of vibe of people that work in restaurants that's just present them with a problem or an issue and they will solve it, you know? And sometimes it goes in a straight line and sometimes it goes in a very, very squiggly line. But the thing is like we're born problem solvers and we do thrive in the muck to a certain extent. And so like opening up a restaurant really puts you in the mud. Like you're in the shit and your back is up against the wall. And like, when does anything go right when you work in a restaurant? And when you own one, even more stuff goes wrong. And so you were probably primed for all of it, even though like on paper, did you know how to do it? Had you taken a class? No, but you had all those elements there. You had all those pieces. I'm wondering, is there anyone that you relied on from past restaurants or friends that were maybe, you know, one or two steps in front of you that you kind of considered like a mentor or like at least someone who had maybe forged that path before you that you could ring up and say, okay, we like actually got to the point on this one item where like, we don't know where to go from here. We don't know where to go left or right. Was there anyone that you, that helped you that you could reach out to, or were you really like totally flying solo?
Well, Peter was a kitchen manager and also a chef and sous chef. Yeah. And, you know, so I'm sorry, Chef Tuzine. And so I, like, he had the experience he had, he knew the ins and outs of how to get that started. So I relied on him for a lot of that stuff. I wasn't, shouldn't sell myself so short. But I really, you know, tried to take mental notes of how my superiors over the years were doing things. I didn't really know. I knew how to take an inventory as of being a bartender, but I looked to him a lot. He did have a lot of those answers. As far as ownership, yeah. I mean, I know we talked to
Lauren and I have a pretty big circle here in LA of like restaurant connections. So if it wasn't like necessarily restaurant owners, we also had friends that were working in other restaurants or in other, you know, hospitality capacities that we could reach out to. There were a couple owners, I think, like
Dustin Lancaster, our former boss at LNE Oyster Bar,
and Tyler. They were the owners of a restaurant that we both worked at. So I remember I actually talked to Tyler, and I was thinking about, because he had owned a few restaurants before. He owns some in Alabama and some here in LA. And for some reason, I remember him telling me that rent should be 5% of your revenue, monthly revenue. And so that was always like a number in my mind that I never really thought about before. As far as like, you know, we didn't have a business plan. We didn't write out any sort of cost analysis or anything.
Oh, we talked to Andy, Andy and Bub and Grandma's, they make our bread.
Yeah.
He was like, do you have a pro forma? You have a business plan? And we were like, no. And he was like, okay, I'm going to send you mine. You can literally just copy and paste it. I don't care. Like, use this, like, this is what you need. But what we realized was like our business plan you should always have a business plan. You should always have a plan. But the people that we were talking to had business partners, financial partners, people who had, you know, equity and partnership in the company, right? So it was relatable, but and so helpful. But also we were like, well, we're not pitching this. We're pitching this like to ourselves. So like, who do we, like, we were just like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was like, I don't know. We just took what we could.
And for people listening that are like, we're getting into some nitty gritty here. So basically what we're talking about is like a pro forma and a pitch deck and taking those things out to market. And traditionally when you would be opening up a business, you would put together a huge document that has, you know, maybe some glitzy visuals of sandwiches and a pro forma is going to have all your revenue sales figures and all your cost of goods and, you know, taxes and all these various, you know, fees that you're going to pay. And then you show that to an investor and you're like, hey, look at that bottom line. Like, there will be profit at the end of the year, right? But what you're basically saying is that you weren't taking this out to market and you had already convinced yourselves that this was a great idea. So if you weren't taking it out to market to raise money and you were starting with all your own money, is that how I'm understanding it? Did you go to a bank and try to get a loan or did you just say cash in hand, we're going to find a location and we're going to rent it?
This is so great. I'm glad you asked that. Also, I misspoke. Andy helped us with our business plan for Lingua Franca. I forgot that Andy and at Bub and Grandma's and us started around the same time. But this is a great question. And I'm sorry, I feel like I'm talking a lot. We did it with our own money. I called the bank and I said, we need a business loan. And they said, okay, how long have you been in business? And I'm like, oh, we're not. And they're like, oh, you have to be in business for 3 years, like, to get a business loan. And I was like, cool. I was like, what about, like, is there like a startup business loan? Like, and kind of like startup money. And they're like,
I remember this conversation.
Literally laughed. Like, he was like, no, that's not a thing. We're like, okay. So I hung up the phone. I called the bank back and I was like, hey, I'm trying to start a business. We have not been in business for 3 years. Like, what do I do? And they said, well, have you put any of your personal money into this project so far? And I was like, yeah, of course. And they were like, oh, okay. I mean, you could get a personal loan to pay yourself back if you would like to do that. And that's fine. And, you know, just make sure the money you're spending is on the business, you're paying yourself back. I'm like, okay. So I got a loan, a very small one. I think it was $26,000, which is a lot of money, but wasn't enough. But it got us through. And, I think it took me like, I think it took us like 4 years to pay it off or something. But, yeah, so we had that. I was working multiple jobs. We had saved a little bit and yeah, that was it. It was like, now let's find a place. Let's find a home, you know, and let's start with that. And we've now moved in together. So we've merged our rent. So like, we're not paying rent at our prospective apartments anymore. So we're paying one rent. So we kind of treated the restaurant as like, well, that'll be our second rent, or, you know, like it was our apartment before we moved in. Foolish things, I'm telling you, but, yeah, we did that. That was our next step. We found a place and we started renting it.
Yeah. We found it. It was very much under construction. And I still remember to this day, I remember like the landlords looking at it and being like, okay, I don't really get it, but, I mean, I guess it could work.
It was 226 square feet.
Yeah. And
226 square feet. Yeah,
people looking at the space are like, you know, nobody really got it. But Lauren and I remember looking at it and seeing it and just like, I could imagine what it would look like without this like chain link fence against the wall. Like that was going to be our little patio where we had tables. And I saw it, like people would walk inside and this is where we prepare the food.
You fell in love with the location, like right when you saw it, do you think like, this is it? I see wax paper here.
Yeah, I think we both did for sure.
I think more you.
Yeah,
I was reticent. Yeah. I was like, dude, like how
look at this
there's
neighborhood.
No
what is this?
Plumbing, there's a, what are you, yeah, like. No, the neighborhood, yeah. No, I thought the neighborhood was the selling point for me because our shop's on the corner. And I was like, I can't wait to meet every single one of these people that live in these houses and be the shop on the corner and be a part of this community. What I was nervous about was like, well, I guess to kind of piggyback on what you said, neighborhood being like, how are people going to find us? We're literally...
Yeah.
Like there's houses, wax paper, houses, you know?
There was no other really retail business.
Yeah.
There were a lot of warehouses and offices, but there wasn't any really retail activity or, you know, people in you know, foot traffic certainly was not really a thing then.
Yeah.
It
was just the size of the space for
but
me.
It was small like, and oh we thought God. We could afford it. So we're like, okay, this is where it is, you know?
Was there a calculus to do sandwiches based on the financial factor? And by that, I mean, you do not require a ton of equipment for sandwiches that you would need if you were doing like multiple pan pickups and you don't need a convection oven necessarily. And I you're not currently baking your bread, right? So it's coming in. So these are all things that require prep space in a kitchen and require like a front end yeah. investment in equipment. So did you think to yourself, sandwiches are good, yeah. people like them, and let's roll with that because it will be cheaper?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
For sure. Definitely.
Million percent.
Yeah.
I mean, so it'd be like, you know, thousands of dollars for a grease trap. Yeah. So we're like, oh, we can't do that. So.
Yeah. It was just like, you know, this is, you know, I think we thrive in, when we have some sort of constraints on ourselves. I like seeing opportunities in places where maybe other people don't see them. And certainly like not having a kitchen, not having a hood, not having a grease trap. We just sort of said, okay, what can we do? You know, we know where to get really good bread. We can get that delivered. There's a really good deli meat company here in Burbank. We can get deli meats. We can make all of our sides can just be, you know, coleslaw, rache, vegetables. There's so many ways to make stuff delicious without necessarily cooking it or, you know, any sort of any of that stuff. And so we just said, you know, like, wow, how, let's get creative. What can we do here?
That's all you. That was subtextual the entire time for Peter. It was like, it was like.
And it was just like, I don't know. I just, we wanted to show that you didn't need to have, you know, this fully built out kitchen to make, you know, really good food that is delicious. You know, people will come like, you know, every single day, you know.
I remember being at the health department and Peter saying, our health and plan checker saying, let me see your menu. He hands him the menu. He's like, oh, potato salad. How are you going to cook that? And Peter's like, oh, I'm an induction burner. I'll boil the potatoes. And nope, can't have an induction burner. Got to have a grease trap if you have an induction burner. So we were like, okay, cool. So we'll strike that from the...
It was just
take
like,
that right off, I guess.
Cool. Yeah. No potato salad. What else can we do?
Yeah. I remember too, we had these wood counters that like we researched and it was like, okay to have them. And he's, oh, absolutely no wood. Are you going to be cutting on them? We're like, no, we're going to have cutting boards on the wood. No, absolutely no wood. We're like, please, it's already there. Can we just, it's in the plan.
It was this like local lumber company.
Yeah, down the street.
Such a great story to have like local lumber in the shop. And it's like so great.
Bring me a sample. Feeling. So he's like, bring me a sample. We had, the only sample we had was like 4 feet long and 3 feet wide, heavy as shit. And we just walked it into the health department and he laughed his ass off at us. He laughed at us. Okay, you can have the wood. I mean, you can't make this shit up. That's literally what happened. And we would be like in the health department and we'd see people who do this for a living, expediters, like brilliant, genius people, to which I will never not work with again. Like expediters, budget for that. But we'd see like expediters walk in and like our health plan checker who couldn't have been colder to us would just look up and be like, hey, how you doing? To the plan checkers. What do you need? You need that? Like push us aside. Like, man, it's like, I'm almost glad we went through that. But
money can move mountains sometimes, but at least now you know how to do everything.
Yeah.
And you got like a real crash course in sort of every aspect of the bureaucracy of opening up a restaurant. That is for sure. I want to ask about sandwiches from like a chef perspective and also like talk a little bit about ego and also expectations because, you know, I run a fast casual restaurant with my brother where what we have tried to do is make really delicious food. It's not fancy. It comes in a compostable bowl. No one's coming here for like a 3-course meal. We had some apprehension at first about how it would be received and also like what it would mean for us as people who took cooking very seriously to just put stuff in a bowl, quote unquote. And so what I ask you is like, you make sandwiches. They are exceptionally delicious sandwiches that you put a ton of care and effort into. What were your thoughts before opening about going from like a traditional kitchen to opening up a sandwich shop? And did you have any of those fears that I had?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, one of the things I think about all the time is like the, you know, if you really want to batten your ego down and tamp your ego down a little bit, you should open a restaurant. Because it will, your ego will disappear. But I think, you know, originally, still to this day, I think like going back to the first thing that we talked about was like, I think, you know, we had this idea that restaurant people will get it. You know, there was not a lot of sandwich places. Surprisingly, I mean, everybody loves sandwiches. Everybody loves making sandwiches. Everybody loves eating sandwiches. Everybody loves ordering sandwiches. But there really weren't a lot of places to get a good sandwich. I mean, Lauren and I went to a couple places that were pretty inspiring here in LA, but you know, there were a couple places, but not really. And yeah, I think from like a chef-y perspective, you know, there is a lot of, I think it's changing for sure. I think over the last 5 years, you know, people's knowledge of what good food looks like and what good food is definitely changing. But, you know, I think, you know, maybe I think I sort of wanted to get out from sort of the traditional restaurant environment, kitchen environment. You know, I think creatively, I definitely think to myself, like, you know, wow, do people, you know, do people take us seriously? Like, is this, do people like this food? Is this, you know, is this like a serious enough concept for people to be like, so to like just selfishly me be taken seriously as a chef? But that sort of goes away when I just think about, no, like I'm really proud of what we do. I'm really proud of our employees. I'm proud of the concept. And what, you know, we just want to make delicious food. It's just delicious. It's honestly, objectively delicious. That's our biggest goal. Like, is the food delicious? Great. You know, is it not, are we going to get Michelin stars? No. But is it delicious? If Michelin inspectors came to Wax Paper, would they say it was delicious? Yes. Like that's the goal, you know, for us, for me, like I just, you know, maybe there was a time in my life where I, you know, was more concerned about, you know, plating something on a plate, but now it's just like, you know, is it delicious? Great. Is that, you know, that's really my like guiding principle. Is it delicious? But is it good? You know? So, and that can, I think that can come in all shapes and sizes and forms.
Yeah. And of course this was no one's plan, but what happened during COVID was that actually flavor became paramount over presentation because everything was going in a box or a bag anyways. Yeah. So that has been an interesting, not a full paradigm shift, but to see people that used to be able to market a restaurant and a dish based on the experience and the plating, right? Like, here's a bite of food, but it comes on this gorgeous ceramic plate and it comes in this gorgeous room. So we're going to charge you $17 for it. Going to, you know what I really want? You know what I really want? I want a delicious sandwich. That's $16. And so it's been exciting to see how the fast casual places that may have been sort of maligned before have been able to really get their time to shine. And so I want to ask about your sandwiches from a construction standpoint, but also the names. Why the names? And then also, how does a sandwich make it on the menu and be like a finalized product? Like, in my opinion, maybe more so than any other dish, it's very hard to edit the contents of a sandwich because sometimes like 16 ingredients in a sandwich is still really delicious. And so I feel difficulty editing sandwich creation. How do you go about creating your dishes on your menu? And when do you finally just say, okay, this one's ready for the menu?
Both of our shops are really small. So I think once we're out of room to store ingredients, that's when it's done, basically.
Nice. Cooking with constraints. I like it.
Yeah. 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 It's a common theme.
That's the shoulders that Wax Paper stands on. It's cooking with constraints.
Yeah.
And why the names?
Well, we're huge public radio nerds and listeners. And that was kind of one of our commonalities, just like, on a personal level, when we started dating, was we both loved to listen to NPR and our local stations, KPCC, and we would be driving and we'd hear the names. And obviously, no surprise, it seems like a requirement to have an amazing name to be a public radio host or producer or writer. And I think I said something like, hey, my brother and I used to like call each other up and pretend to be these hosts. And I just think, what if we like named our sandwiches like something funny? And we had just watched the episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm 2 where Larry David wants to switch his sandwich with Ted Danson and, yeah. and all this stuff. And we just kind of like in that moment married that idea and we're like, yeah, let's name him after like public radio hosts. That'd be sweet. Like yeah. better than ham and cheese or, you know, if we name him after Seinfeld characters, we'll probably get a cease and desist. So like, we can't do that, you know? And like, you know, there was definitely no like, oh, maybe we'll get publicity out of this. But there was absolutely like, well, I think that the people that work in radio would like be cool with it. Like, I don't think that they would be like cease and desist. I think they'd be like, oh, wow, there's a sandwich named after me. How cool, you know? So that's yeah. kind of how we came up yeah. with it.
We wanted to have fun with it too. And just like humor is a big principle at Wax Paper and like, and things that we do. I think humor is very underlooked in the restaurant industry. So we try to provide a lot of that with our stuff. And that, I think the names speak to that. But yeah, I'm just so thankful that every single person, you know, these hosts like, you know, Kai Rizdahl or Hedy Lynn Curtis, like Larry Mantle, they'll come in, they live in LA. They'll come into the shop, they'll order their sandwich. And I'm so thankful that it's worked out as well as it has because, you know, we that's the most personal thing to somebody is your name. And we just took that and made a sandwich, you know, named a sandwich after it. And, you know, everybody has been so, you know, has just gotten it and been like, this is cool. I love this idea. So I feel really thankful to them for, you know, just, you know, keeping on board with us and going along for the ride. So
I think too, like we want to be our sandwiches to be a twist on classics. So I think if you look at our menu, to answer your question about how a sandwich makes it on the menu, I think maybe an unspoken requirement is like, is there some classic element to this sandwich that we're twisting on, you know? And I think yeah. all of them uphold that, you know. We save the wild kind of like
we do get kind
funky
of crazy
stuff for specials, like yeah. actual specials, which we do every Thursday. We've done a special every Thursday, I think, except maybe one during the pandemic. We were just like, we can't do it. But for 6 years, you know, we've done a special every Thursday. You've done a special every Thursday. Our staff's done a special. I can take no credit. And they've all been different week to week. I don't think we've ever or maybe rarely repeated a special. Those are the ones where yeah. that have like 16 ingredients yeah. off the rails. We can't yeah. even, we don't even offer like taking stuff off of those because they're just too wild. Like, you know, the olives are likely mixed into the sauce. Like they're not separate, you know, or whatever. So
yeah.
Yeah. Save yeah. the funky ones for Thursdays. But
I love everything about the names. I think it's so wonderful because you basically like elevated these people who no one can see and who no one probably really thinks about. Like you've made them superstars because the only people who get sandwiches named after them are like huge, huge, huge celebrities, you know, like Ted Danson and Larry David. So like I get a right. huge kick out of the fact that they come in and order their own sandwiches. They probably think it is the most amazing thing. And yeah. I bet that to a certain extent, they wish that they were like, had recognizable faces so that when they came in, people would be like, oh my God, is that, you know, is that Larry right there? I just got your sandwich.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I wonder if they yeah. ever like consider like putting their NPR badges like on display so that somebody might notice them when they come in.
We're going to take a quick break. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more of The Line here on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our Heritage and Traditions Master Cheesemaker Program and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to jump back into the wax paper episode with Peter talking us through one of their most popular dishes, not a sandwich, and explaining how the Aloha pasta salad came to be.
The pasta salad was something that we worked, we sort of were batting this idea around with Ben, who's one of our longest employees. He's been with us about 4 years.
It's our first full-time employee.
Yeah.
And he's from New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
He was born and raised in Manhattan, and for some reason the stars aligned and he is working with us now in LA, and it's, you know, can't do it without him. But we were just batting around an idea of like, you know, like we have like the ends of the ham, right? That you can slice on the deli slicer, but then you're left with this little piece of ham, which is perfectly good. So like, why are we going to give that away or throw it away or use it for family meal? That's a, you know, something you can use. And, for some reason we were talking about, ham and pineapple pizza. And then we started talking about pasta salad. And I think coincidentally, just at this time, there was another local, maker who was starting this pasta company, this dried pasta company, Semolina. She would bring samples by and say, hey, if you guys are ever thinking about doing a pasta salad, you know, I make dried pasta here in town. I'd love for you guys to use it. And so that sort of continued this evolution of like, okay, now we have a source of pasta. We just sort of, you know, Ben and I are very like-minded, and I think we like to get, you know, sort of creative and fun. And so the idea was like, what about like the flavors of Hawaiian pizza in pasta salad? So that's where like pineapple, and then we can use up these ends of the ham. We have jalapenos, and then like ham and peas. So then now we're talking about like green peas come into the mix. And then going back to those flavors where it's like kind of rich and a little bit acidic from the pineapple and sweet. And then, you know, that speaks to like a lot of our creativity too with our sandwiches and the food is like, everything is like, we really want to get balance in everything. So there's always like something sour, something sweet, something salty, maybe something a little bit bitter from like the burned parts of the bread. So everything is kind of like balanced in that way. So that's how we really started to like create food. And so we just started thinking about the pasta salad that way.
I think it originally had chunks of pecorino in it too.
It did. It had chunks of cheese. But then, you know, we're eating it and we're like, okay, but what if it was like, this is pasta. Like when you get a bowl of pasta, you grate cheese over the top. So what if we took that pecorino and then grated it over the top? That when you eat it, that tastes a lot better than the chunks.
Togarashi.
But yeah, and we had, so it has grated pecorino and togarashi on the top, again, just to reinforce those flavors of like what's inside the pasta salad. And then the dressing is basically like,
it's the dish.
Yeah.
The dressing has everything that's in the dish.
Yeah. The dressing is just like,
pasta.
Yeah, like the cores of the pineapple, ends of like red onion, pecorino cheese, same thing. We're like, you're grating pecorino cheese. You get down to a nub that you can't really grate anymore. So you save it. So that gets blended up into the dressing. So it's like everything that's in the dish is like blended up and that becomes the dressing. So it's just a way to like you try and utilize like as much of things that we have around. And then also like make something delicious and fun. So that's, you know, Hawaiian pizza. So then it's Aloha pasta salad. So, you know, that's sort of like, you know, I think how that came to be was just like, what do we have here? How can we use them in a new and like fun way?
Yeah, it's an amazing exercise in not wasting and also just being creative in the same way that you that making family meals led to your business. This is, you're innovating from existing product. Like you didn't have to go out too far to find what you needed. Like It was at arm's length. I want to ask about your employees. You've mentioned that you have 12 employees, which is really amazing. Like, part of starting a business is for you, and then you quickly realize that like people rely on the business to be successful, and that you have employees that you need to take care of. What has that experience been like, going from pretty much lifelong employees to now you're the employers?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to that. I think being an employee for so long, kind of how I mentioned earlier, really gave us the sort of, I'm trying to think of the right word. It just gave us the basics, understandings and needs of people. You know, I mean, we've worked in so many different environments and restaurants where maybe you saw the owner once every couple of years, or, you know, once a day or once a week. You know, what's their presence? Like, what's their participation? One of my favorite stories was when Peter was working at Kraft, he came in to the kitchen, and this person was mopping. And as he got closer, it was just Tom Colicchio, like, mopping his own restaurant. So it was just like, oh, hey, chef, you know, and so like those experiences and what kind of owners we'd want to be. I think the answer came from that we're still young. Like, I guess there was always kind of a perception that owners were just like kind of older, not to sound ageist, but just like maybe like older or in a different profession, like not really trying to work the line or anything. Like, the line is like where that's like us. That's like where we want to be. And like, we're young. We're like not ready to like retire. We don't want to just be like with our arms behind our backs, walking around our restaurants, being like, clean that up. Like, obviously not our vibe, you know. We want to work in the restaurant. So part of taking care of our employees, I think, just on a simple level, was like being there, working the line, covering for them, showing them how we want things to be done, by leading by example, not telling them to do something, but doing it and letting someone observe how we like it done. And it's amazing to me to hear our employees when they're like, I've overheard employees say like, oh no, like we do it this way, or this is how Lo and Peter want it done, you know, like, but not in a fearful way, just like showing the way. Yeah. And so that was important, like taking out the trash, washing dishes, like none of these things that we're above as people or employees, like not going to give those things up being just because we're owners. Those are also things that if you really care about your restaurant, care about your employees, you want to be participating in. And so I think by being arm in arm with our employees, it was the kind of most basic way we could take care of them. Like I said, being available to cover, or, and then we have, I know Suzanne mentioned this in her episode, like we have equitable tip pool share between the front and the back of the house, dishwasher, everybody. Nobody makes this percentage or this, it's equitable. And so that was a major incentive for people to come work with us, because, you know, we don't need to get into all the, you know, we know how much that hurts to be, I can't speak to it because I've been a server. So I guess in essence, I've always made the highest percentage of tips, right? But meeting Peter and having those conversations about even him seeing me count my money at the end of the night, like I could feel it. And he's like, can I say something? You know, like, it's hard to watch. This is why there was, I guess what I'm getting at is like, this is why there was so much animosity between the front and the back of the house in all the restaurants I worked in, right? It's no secret that there's no like yin and yang, that like, it's like almost a war, right? And what are we doing? We're one restaurant. We're trying to set one goal. So I think equitable tip share is like, and at one point, you know, this equitable tip share was illegal in California. Like, you couldn't give tips to back of the house. In fact, we found out that from our wonderful attorney that what we did for the first year of business by doing equitable tip share was illegal. So for the first year that we had an employee, he was like, well, I mean, you're doing it, but you're not supposed to be. I'm like, not supposed to be paying. So I don't understand. Like, that should be a company policy. Yeah. Long, long-winded, but so that you know, that was major. We knew, like, at one point, like, as soon as we can afford it, we want to have health, you know, offer a healthcare plan, even if it's just sponsored at a certain percentage. Like, we want to offer something in that way. But I think I could go on and on. But I think, like, the biggest way we tried to take care of our employees was by growing slowly. And for the first year and a half, it was just Peter and I. And I remember customers saying, like, you guys need help. You need employees. Like, the waits are too long. Like, you know, this is getting out of hand. You guys are tired. Like, yeah. You know.
It was funny. It even almost wasn't even a thought that we would have employees. Like, it was just, we just opened up. We were so, like, focused on just getting the shop open and opening, creating this business, that it was just Lauren and I doing it. And we didn't even really imagine a world where, like, we would have employees or, you know, we were so focused in the day to day. But that was such an important step, like, you know, hiring employees. And from that very moment of, like, hiring employees, we were like, we knew, you know, we needed to have, this wasn't just going to be like, hey, you're a buddy, come work for cash under the table. It was like, no, we're going to have, all the documents are going to be there. You're going to be paid fairly. There's going to be benefits. All the laws are going to be followed to the letter. We're going to have employee handbooks. We're going to have all this stuff to make it, like, you know, a actual job, a career for people. And I think as a business owner, somebody that has employees, it's very important to really take a look and think, like, would I want to work here? If I'm an employee, is this a place I would want to work here? What are the things that I would expect, or what are the things that I would really would help me enhance my job as an employee here? Like, have those thoughts with yourself. I think that's it's invaluable. You really just, like, think, like, how, you know, these people are working with us, and you know, how would I, you know, it's like the golden rule, like, you know, don't, you know, lead by example. Like, don't ask, you know, we never ask somebody to do something that we wouldn't do ourselves. So
yeah, like, you have a responsibility to not forget where you came from, right? Yeah. Let's not stray away from our goal, which is to create a place that embraces the things we loved about working in a restaurant and does away with the things that we didn't love, you know? And, you know, I think what I try to bring to the table as far as, like, keeping our staff in mind is just recalling, you know, cutting servers getting cut. Like, how many tables do you have? And granted, we don't have that setting where quick service to go restaurant, but, you know, I wanted to have a space that I think having the small space that we do, thanks to Peter, allows a smaller staff to have more high volume. And, you know, most of the people we hire are like, I want to be busy. Like, I want to be, like, slammed, you know? And, like, you know, our front of the house, like, everybody works so hard. We're an open kitchen too. That was another element of, like, you know, kind of creating that sort of, like,
doing away with
everybody,
like,
does everything, yeah. Right? Like, we all do everything. Like, okay, so I'm kind of, again, my mind's going a million miles a minute, but it's like, okay, we could really use a dishwasher, right? But let's think about this. Like, this is an extra body in this small space that we already are bumping into each other. Absolutely, we'll tip this person. This person will be in the tip pool. Like, is this something that we all just want to pitch in and get done and, like, have it be, like, financially a better, you know, option for us? And, like, we're working a little harder, but we're also in that came this more, like, humble care for our place, right? Like, we just care more about everything because we mop the floors and we sweep the floors and we do the dishes and we do that. Like, we see, and it's funny because we just recently hired our first prep dishwasher. His name is Rob. He's amazing. And then we've just hired a Woody down in Chinatown. And when they take a day off, or, like, when they, you know, like, Rob took a day off recently and I worked for Rob, and I was like, when he came back, I was just like, dude, I already knew, like, I already saw you. I already appreciated you, like, beyond belief, but, like, my God, like, you know, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for what you do, because it's, we feel the loss when you're not here, you know?
It's like, it's crazy to think about the fact of like, you know, when you have a small business and you're like, wow, you just think about the cost of hiring somebody, but then it's like, just, it's an investment. And if you invest in these people, it's like, wow, everybody can do so much more than you could do on your own.
We grew with each employee. Yeah, we grew, exactly. Our business grew.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's just like interesting how that works when you, you know, make those sort of investments in people, and it really just, you know, the team just thrives, you know?
I don't know if that really answers the question. I'm sorry. I feel like
it did. Yeah. We covered it. It definitely, I mean, it's all about, like, you know, getting to a point where you feel confident having people that are at your business who you can leave. Like you said that you didn't even think you were going to have employees. So you thought you were going to stand there 17 hours a day, every single day. And now you have people that you can trust. And I'm sure that physically and mentally, that was a game changer when you turned that corner and you were like, oh my God, I have something to do today. And like, I'm actually going to go and do it because I don't need to be here 100% of the time the doors are open. Like there's something romantic about that notion of, you know, I'm going to interact with every single customer and make every single thing that leaves the door. But now you have two locations. Yeah. So that's literally impossible. Even if you wanted to at one, it was probably impossible. I wonder, once you've seen what you can do at two locations, are you like, oh my God, we could do another one? Or are you thinking to yourself, let's pump the brakes and kind of consolidate what we've got going on? Or now are you just like throttling forward and thinking to yourself, let's look for another spot and sign a lease and do number three?
I think there's a lot of questions to answer, to think about like a third one. But I think like having more wax papers is possible. But it's just interesting to think about what kind of, what that would mean for like the business. Cause I think just, you know, the nature of the business will have to change to have more locations, and there will be, you know, you have to compromise on certain things in order to grow. Lauren and I have some, you know, wild ideas about possibly more wax papers, but in the moment we're trying to get our third business off the ground, Lingua Franca. So that's sort of in the front of our minds.
We've been tempted under construction, a couple of times,
but we've definitely been tempted. Developers have reached out to us like, oh, we have this brand new, you know, complex, and it's, you know, by the beach, and it's going to be great. And, you know, it's tempting, but it's also like, well, how is this actually going to work? Like, is this going to, you know?
Yeah.
So there's all like, you know, a lot of questions like that. And it's, you know, we're comfortable with the two that we have, right now. It's a lot of work. I don't even know what that would entail, having like a third business. I don't know.
I don't know that we could have multiple locations without having some sort of arm of like someone who already works with us running it, right? Like, you know, we've kind of like, I don't know if I should say this, but we've kind of like talked about maybe coming to New York, right? With Ben, who's from there, you know, like, hey, what would that look like? Like, Ben's working on his own concept pretty good, which is amazing. And I want to shout out. And, you know, we kind of talk about things like that. So I think expansion would come with, it would be very near and dear. Like, I'm not sure that we could just like set up a whole crew of people we just barely met. And it's not like we wouldn't trust that they would do a great job. It's just that I think so much of wax paper is, you know, kind of going back to like our staff. It's like, I know the word family is tossed around a lot in the industry. It's controversial. People are like, it's not family, it's your job, right? Or like, you shouldn't, you know, this shouldn't treat people like family because they're working for you. It's like, that's just not really like the truth with us. Like, our restaurants are, you know, we have employees who have been, most of our employees have been with us at least a year, some for four, going on five, you know, a couple. And so it's hard because that's what makes our stores really special. You know, our customers go to see like these people, and that could be recreated. With, like, in other words, like, how do I say this? Like, I know like another store would have amazing people who would have, you know, their regulars and people who come to see them. But again, it's just what the two stores have right now is like a big family. It's really special. It's hard, you know, and dare I say that you can't replicate that, but that if you did create another one, it would just be different. It would be different. Yeah. One of the biggest things about expanding wax paper is we don't know where we would source bread, because Bob and Grandma's in France, who we work with right now, like, that's, you know, that is a humongous reason why people love wax paper, is we have fresh bread baked every day right up the street, literally in Frogtown, you know? And so it's by the most incredible, you know, one of the most incredible bakeries in Los Angeles. And so we would have to find a Bub and Grandma's somewhere else. So we'd have to open near a good bread place that could supply to us. That's a big part of our business model.
Yeah, so it's what a lot of people don't think of when they're those opportunities get dangled in front of you, and you start to see stars and dollar signs and acclaim and opportunity. Yeah. And what it sometimes is really important to think about what the pure logistics are of you having to haul your ass all across town to check on a location that's far, and also supply chain, staff, like, going from one to two is very, very hard, but going from two to three, a lot of people say, is a whole different ballgame. And trying to vertically integrate is like a whole other can of worms. So I totally understand where you're coming from on that. You are, though, embarking on a third business. So you've sort of like, you've eased off on the wax paper expansion, but you are opening up another concept that we don't know anything about. So tell everyone who's listening what that is going to be, where it's going to be, whatever you can share about Lingua Franca. Start plugging it right now. Let us know what we can get excited for.
Yeah, Lingua Franca, we've been working on Lingua Franca for about 4 years. We met, the landlord was a customer of ours, and now he's you know, become a friend of what we were doing at Wax Paper. And, you know, we signed a lease 4 years ago, and, you know, now we're under construction, and it's taken, you know, 4 years and a pandemic to work through to you know, get to a point where we're almost open. Hopefully we're going to be open later this year. You know, it's pretty insane what Lauren and I are trying to do. We don't have any investors. We don't have any outside, you know, there's no outside people. It's Lauren and I, and that's, you know, we are the owners, and that's it. And the space that we're going into for Lingua Franca is right along the LA bike path. It's in Frogtown. It's a couple blocks away from where Wax Paper is in Frogtown. And it was just four walls and a roof. So if you can imagine trying to translate that into an actual working restaurant, there's an incredible amount of hoops and planning and fees and, you know, like, construction that has to be dealt with in order to create a restaurant from where there was only a shell of a building. But that's, you know, it's taken 4 years. We're under construction. We've met some really, really amazing people who have worked with us and saw the vision and are, you know, moving forward on it with us. You know, really a dream too, to be able to have total control, like Lauren and I have, of a business. You know, from the color of the walls to the type of cooking equipment that we have,
the music we play,
the menu. You know, people hear Lingua Franca and they say, oh, is it an Italian restaurant? Or, you know, Like, well, it's lingua franca, as it really, I don't really know where it's a term that means sort of like the common language. So in our case, when we think about the restaurant, the common language is good food. So that's really where, how far the concept is. It's just good food. I don't know, you know, it's not going to be, you know, a Sardinian restaurant or a Mexican restaurant or a, you know, it's going to be sort of a California restaurant. The food is going to be, I want to do as much as I can to just source products and ingredients from California. Like if there's any concept, that's the concept. It's a California restaurant. And then, you know, having fun with the food, going back to our guiding principle from earlier, like, is it delicious? You know, that's really like the goal. It's not, you know, there's no sort of, you know, it's just a modern, you know, Californian restaurant with good food and
family style.
Yeah. If, you know, if we, you know, if we want to have, you know, I don't know, certain dishes on the menu, it's just going to be, you know, the menu is constantly going to be changing. And I think that's sort of my restless creativity. I can't really, you know, I'm always thinking about, is this as good as it can be? Can this be better? You know, and just, you know, we're so close to, you know, beautiful seafood and beautiful farmers markets here in Southern California that it's just, you know, I'm talking with purveyors and basically it's just going to be like, drop off what you have and we'll make it, you know, like I got some black cod, off of Santa Barbara and a couple spiny lobsters. I'm like, great, cool. Then bring that in. You know, like I don't want to look at like what's available at the produce at the farmer's market and check boxes and then have them bring that. Like I would rather them bring in, you know, a case of cauliflower and a case of Swiss chard and some, you know, beautiful peaches. And then that's what we're going to serve. And I think at this point, you know, I think at this point, our customers are willing to go on that journey with us. I think that they trust us if they haven't really ever had, you know, a certain, I don't know, combination or a dish in a way that we do it. I think that our customers are really trusting in what we do and they believe in, the concept. So I'm just excited to get creative and, you know, to have fun and bring the humor into a restaurant that I feel was like sorely lacking for a long time. But yeah, I think, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, we're going to be, I don't know if it's me standing in an empty room over a stove cooking, burgers, then that's what it's going to be. You know, if we have to, you know, if we're going to open up and do that, that's what it's going to be. But we're really trying to focus on getting it done by the end of the year.
Will there be a grease trap in the hood?
Oh, yeah. There will be.
Will there ever be? Yes, we're working on the hood right now. Actually, we're deep into huge email chains and between structural engineers and hood companies and equipment people and, you know, they're going to have to crane this hood onto the top of this restaurant. And so there will be, absolutely.
It's ridiculous.
You know, thank our landlord really believed in us. And so he gave us a great lease. So he's really taken on a lot of the, you know, a big chunk of the, of that sort of infrastructure as well, which is great. Cause otherwise if we had to build it, this entire thing from scratch on, you know, with us, there's no way we could do it. So we feel great that we have a landlord who's so, you know, who sees the vision and is so willing to work with us to make it happen.
That's amazing. You know, sometimes a landlord can be a partner, even if they're not writing you a huge check and asking for an investment. I think most landlords, and you know, I can only truly speak to New York, but you're a name on a piece of paper, I think, to most landlords. And then every once in a while, you hear about landlords who see vision and see ingenuity and see an exciting opportunity, which is what sounds like your landlord has seen. And it's great to hear that there's some trust there and some optimism for helping grow a neighborhood, which increases their property value, and doing cool things in a community. And it's like, if you can have that foresight as a landlord, then you can bring in cool operators like the two of you. It's a win-win. I don't know why more people don't operate that way, but what you've just described is a very rare situation. So I'm hoping that it works out like brilliantly for you. And I'm hoping that it can end up, I want you to be really successful, and I want it to be an inspiration to people to do exactly what you're doing, which is find somebody that likes their spot and say, hey, like, let's make another cool thing happen together. So that is awesome to hear and super exciting. I would be remiss to not talk and touch on COVID, which is still going on. And as restaurant owners, something that we're going on almost 2 years having to deal with. So I don't want to close on a bummer, but I do want to hear from you because you've been open quite a while now, and you know, you are a pretty like small operation, which didn't have a huge infrastructure and apparatus, you know, to support you. You know, it's you two and your small team. Yeah. So like, I guess basically what I would love for you to talk about was like, what did you do during COVID that allowed you to either be successful or like not have your brain explode? And what were the hardest things that happened during COVID that as a small business owner, it almost like took you to the brink and made you feel like you might not maybe make it to the other side if that did happen?
Yeah. This could be like the whole episode.
I know. Yeah. We could talk about this for another hour. So
yeah, I think, you know, I'm fortunate that we did, you know, just from the beginning, we were kind of set up as a small to go place and we didn't have a huge staff to support. We didn't have, you know, we were able to make the rent work. You know, it was the thing that was maybe like most stressful was really like not getting, you know, not necessarily getting like absolute guidance from any sort of like health authority or city or county.
Still waiting.
Yeah. Like still, and just
still waiting.
Just like, if we had an employee who said like, hey, we had, I was out somewhere and I think I was, you know, in, I might've been exposed to COVID-19. So then it's just like, our only option then is to like, okay, you have to take time off and you have to get tested. And, you know, just from, you know, from us too, as people trying to navigate this thing that like no one has lived through before. And just, you know, not getting that like clear guidance from any sort of authority and just all of the responsibility on navigating a pandemic was really left to the individual business owner for the most part, was incredibly challenging. If there was anything that really made us think like, this is not worth it, I think it was that. It was just like, we know how to be small business owners, but we don't know how to be public health officials. So like, you know, when we had to like add that role to our multitude of hats, it was like almost too much. I mean, thankfully, yeah, we had a great crew. We kept our circle small and, you know, we were able to navigate it as well as we could. Yeah. And, you know, we were sort of slowly coming out the other side, but it was very tough. We can't work from home, so it was tough. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, being and I say this completely gratefully because I hold a huge respect and, you know, a lot of emotion for all of our friends and family in this industry who did not have a quick service takeout concept and had to close their doors either, you know, temporarily or forever. You know, emotionally, that was really hard to grapple with, like seeing that. I felt personally like a sense of survivor's guilt a lot of times. I felt like sort of isolated, like I can't express my feelings or complain or like do anything because we're just lucky to be here. This is our livelihood. We don't have a backup job. Our staff, this is their job. Unemployment's a nightmare to get right now. You can't even get through to them. You know, I had friends who didn't get their first check for a month and a half, you know, things like that. It's just, it being a takeout restaurant and being open was just a small part of it. It was like, okay, we're lucky to be open. How do we survive this? You know, and just how do we survive this from a health standpoint? And then how do we survive this as a small business? And, you know, the first couple months was a sheer panic and lots of ups, you know, roller coasters and ups and downs that have, you know, sustained. But I think that we owe so much to our staff. And, you know, we talked earlier about taking care of staff and it's really, I remember a conversation with Peter where we said, like, we're already always at the restaurant, but we are not, there's not going to be one day of this pandemic that we're open, that we are not there all day. Like, we are going to be there every single day, all day, every day. And it was, you know, no question that we weren't going to be sitting at home while our staff's working our restaurant. Like, that's not going to happen. And together with them, I mean, shit, it's like we cried, we laughed, we probably, you know, I mean, we ordered family meal like every day, despite like worrying about our finances to try to support our friends. They'd order from us. We trade, you know, we set up a fort. Like, it still looks like a fort in both of our restaurants, like chairs on the table, collected dust, you know, like we clean it, but you know what I mean? Like, it, because of our net of friends and family and our staff, that's number one, why we're still here. You know, I guess in no particular order, one of the reasons why we're here. We don't have business partners other than ourselves that we had to speak to or answer to or give money to. And that was another heartbreaking element of so many of our friends' businesses, was seeing the way, like, I literally teared up listening to Suzanne Barr talk about her partners being like, we don't want to do this anymore. Like, there's no money. You know, it's just like, oh my God, like, the word is partner. Like, how do you give money and invest in something and not emotionally invest in it either? And that is why we stop trying to seek partnership for Lingua Franca, because we're there every day. We're like, we're doing this. Like, we want ownership in this. But so there's that element. And then being the takeout restaurant and just sort of like, I don't know, just being, taking it one day at a time and being okay with inevitably what happened, because we have the support of our friends in the industry, our friends' life, family and life, and our staff.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, it's just a one day at a time kind of thing. And it still is. And now that the understanding, like, outside, like, if you're not in this industry, is like, oh, you guys made it through, you know? And it's like a gut punch, because it's like, there's so many pieces to pick up. There's so much rubble to rifle through, and like so much, you know, back pay and this kind of stuff. So it's just like, you know, like, it's just, you know, vendors closing down and not being able to deliver produce to you. So you're going to Whole Foods 365 because that's the closest grocery store, and you're spending triple what you know, like, just, and then there's not even groceries there. Like, how do you even run a business like this? Like, you know, our poor bakery, like, they had a COVID outbreak. It's like, so we didn't have bread, you know, and we were so lucky to work with Clark Street Bakery, who saved us, you know, and then we actually had so much support from our customers, but, you know, I'm sure it was a different product for them. And they were like, I'm not going to say anything, but like, and I don't mean lesser, I just mean different than what they were used to. Right. And so, like, different style, different this, different, I don't know. I could go on and on, but all praise to our staff. They're incredible people. They take ownership. They, you know, we trust them, and it's just, yeah, it's just wild to be standing here. But
yeah, it was inspiring to go through it with other, you know, all the other small businesses and all the other small business restaurants, just knowing that they were going through the same thing, and you know, seeing our friends open a patio one day and then close it and then switch to takeout and then, you know, go to different delivery companies and do different things just to like try and keep the lights on. It was really, you know, it was just, I was really inspired by other, you know, other people in the community, you know, and like, you know, hey, I can't, and you know, I'm not working right now, or, you know, our investors bailed to close the restaurant, but I'm going to start this cool pop-up, you know, like that was, you know, inspiring, I think, to us as well, to just like, you know, help us keep moving forward. Like we can't go back. So we're just going to keep moving forward.
Well, the lights are still on, and
yeah,
the Evan Kleiman still fly out the door, and the Ira glasses still fly out the door. So we're all happy that you're still alive and that you've got two locations, going with what sounds like an exciting third spot on the way. Tell everyone who's listening, what are the two location addresses and also where they can find you, website and Instagram?
Well, you can find us at waxpaperco.com. At waxpaperco is our Instagram and Twitter. We have a Facebook we don't keep up, so it's really old. I'm sorry if anybody messaged us there. Meta. We have a meta. so that's Facebook's new name.
When you put on your augmented reality goggles, you can find us
on Meta. So sick. And I think it says our birthday is 1905. So that's accurate. But yeah, we're in Frogtown, 2902 Knox Avenue, Los Angeles, California, 90039. And we're down in Chinatown on Broadway at 736 North Broadway. We're inside the United Foods building, across from the Far East Plaza where Helen Reyes and everyone lives. And that's 90012 Chinatown. That's where we're at. And then hopefully soon at Lingua Franca, to be determined.
Awesome. Peter and Lauren, thank you so much for taking time away from your businesses to speak with me. Everybody go check them out. They're always at the shops, so you can go and find them at those two locations of Wax Paper. Appreciate you sharing your story with me and all of the listeners on Heritage Radio Network.
The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.